paper.
Welcome to episode 114 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Dorothy Field, a visual artist who uses handmade paper for sculptural works and artist books, and is the author of Paper and Threshold, The Paradox of Spiritual Connection in Asian Cultures. In this book, Field examines a wide range of papers at thresholds in many parts of Asia, and its uses in Shinto, shamanic, and Buddhist temples, as well as paper kites, lanterns, doors, and windows. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Dorothy Field, welcome to Paper Talk.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to talking about your journey with paper. And let's start with just a brief background, where you grew up and any childhood influences that you think maybe led you to paper and art and creativity and poetry.
Well, I was born in New York City. I grew up in the suburbs. And my mother was kind of an artist, not very serious. And as a kid, one of the things I did was just sit around and draw my hands.
So you would look at your hand and draw it?
I would have them in different positions and draw them in all different positions.
Did you see drawn hands, or where do you think that came from? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. I think it was just something there that changed. So I owned my hands. I could change them.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then I moved to California because I had spent a couple of summers there, and I had lived in the city, and I couldn't wait to leave New York. I mean, I loved the museums, all that stuff, but actually living in New York, it was not wonderful in those days. We lived in a not wonderful, my best friend and I lived in an apartment that wasn't wonderful, and I thought Berkeley was wonderful, so I went.
Okay, so this, what year was this, and what period of your life? Was it college, or?
After college.
After college.
College was finished.
Where'd you go?
My friend Karen and I shared an apartment the year after college, and the city was scary in those days, yeah.
And this was the 60s?
So I graduated in 1966. So it was 66, 67.
Okay. And where did you go to college?
University of Rochester.
Ah, okay. And what did you study?
Well, I first majored in art history, but I hated the way they talked about art. So I quit that. And I thought I'd major in English literature. I hate the way they talked about English literature. So I majored in history because it was a very kind of loose and open-ended department, and you didn't have to learn. They were very open. They didn't care about dates. And so I thought, oh, this is good. So I majored in history without any real interest. And then through paper, I developed an interest in history. But that was by chance.
Okay. And so you moved to Berkeley just on your own?
Yep. I had good friends there. Okay. And I moved. Yep. And I had a job working with women who were in rehab, and we did various textile things. I majored in textiles when I was at Berkeley. So
Okay, wait, I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
Because my grandmother went to Berkeley.
Yeah.
Before you. Because you're close to my mother's age. So, you know, a couple decades before. And she, I don't know if she was in the textiles department. She was in home ec. I think that's what
that's
was,
what it was
for women.
Then. Yes.
Yeah. And she wrote her thesis about cotton. And you know, the history of cotton for weaving,
right?
And textiles.
Yep.
And yeah, so I just discovered that a few years ago.
Anyway, I, at a certain point, I realized that Berkeley, the UC Berkeley was down the street from me. So I applied to go. And I was doing textiles there. And I had great professors, absolutely brilliant professors. And but I had... in the job that I was doing, there was this guy, and we started hanging out. And then he was moving to Canada because he hated what was going on in California, in the U.S. All it was very violent times.
Uh-huh.
And
Yeah.
So I followed him. I mean, he invited me to follow him. So that's how I got to Canada.
Okay. And what about, how did you end up studying textiles? Was there some history?
I always sort of had a feeling for textiles. My uh-huh. father liked to sail, and I would sit on that boat, and he had an Ashley book of knots, and I would practice knots. And I had some understanding of thread. So that's how.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And I saw some
book.
Great exhibits. I mean, when I was in Berkeley, I mean, in New York, of course, there were great exhibits of textiles and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
What happened.
Okay. 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 So you went to Canada.
Yep.
And what happened next? Oh.
Well, I spent the first year weaving my woven thesis for UC Berkeley. And then... I had to try to figure out how to live in Canada.
Okay, so at that point in time, you could do a remote thesis? Or how did that work?
Well, it wasn't remote. I just was in on Vancouver Island weaving. And
okay.
Then I drove everything down after about 4 months and showed my professors. And they had a few suggestions. I drove everything back. And 6 months later, I drove it all down there. And I completed.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And my thesis was on nomadic textiles.
Ah.
So there, I had no sense that I was interested in anthropology, but there was an anthropological
sure
component. Yeah.
And what did you actually weave for your thesis?
I wove a hanging baby cradle. I wove these things that nomads should own.
Uh-huh.
They obviously were not really nomadic. They were, but yeah.
Oh, very cool. And you wove it in the style of...
really,
no,
I just
or were you more
looked
contemporary?
I looked at a lot of stuff and...
Mm-hmm.
I move on from there.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't trying to. And at that point, I invented a card weaving technique. I really did invent it, how I could make card woven network. So I wove some tents, and one was a big tent all with this card woven network. And when I brought that back to Berkeley, one of my wonderful professors suggested that I make another layer. And so I sat in this room for about 2 months, hard weaving this network. I mean, it was a little crazy, but anyway, that's what I did.
Ah, and did anyone, has this card weaving style been
I have no idea.
You have no idea. It's just something.
I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, how did you find paper?
So I've been trying to really think about that. But I think the main thing was I went back to New York and I went to the what was then the American Museum, Craft Museum, whatever it was called. And I saw this book about Eiichiro Abe. It wasn't a book. It was a tiny little thin thing. And there were actual samples. And I was just completely blown away. And weaving, it comes much more from the head in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I sensed that it was a way to get out of my head. And so I started trying to figure out how to make paper.
Now tell us who Eiichiro Abe is. And
okay.
Was this, you said this is a tiny thing. Was it like part of an exhibit or was it just some?
I don't think it was. I think it was just in the shop. But I don't actually remember.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And Eiichiro Abe was a true living treasure. Mm-hmm. And he basically worked with Gompy, and his plain Gompy paper was so luminous, was so beautiful, and it was so open and plain, and it just spoke without. And I think I was feeling that the weaving was too coming out of my brain, and I wanted to leave my brain a little bit. So I guess I started mucking around. There was nobody I knew nearby, and then I took a stupid class from somebody who really didn't know anything, and you know, bit by bit. Mm-hmm. And I didn't try to think back in a couple of years later, my husband, by then husband, and I started traveling in Asia. We first went to IPC 83. Well, I went and he and my daughter joined afterwards.
Now tell me about that, because I'm not aware of that conference.
Okay, International Paper Conference in Kyoto.
Okay.
And it was quite fantastic. And Kim Yong-yeon, great Korean paper maker, was there, and he did demonstrations. There were a number of hands-on demonstrations that were quite fantastic. So the next year, my husband was an alternate school teacher, and the school district was low on cash, so they offered people who had been teaching for quite a while, well, the top years, and so the most expensive, a year off and $8,000, and we had 4 days to decide. And so we decided to take it.
Yeah.
And so that was the year right after IPC. And so I knew we would look for paper. And by that time I was making paper, but I can't remember how I figured out how to do it, but I was doing it. Yeah. And so I worked in Kim Yong-yeon's studio. I mean, he himself was really an intellectual and a historian, and he had done a huge amount of research into paper, and he was a librarian, and he noticed that the old paper lasted forever and the new paper was not so good. And so he started figuring out how to make very, very good paper. And now,
was he from, it sounds like he maybe came from the outside. He was not from a paper making family that had made paper.
You know, I doubt that he was. Okay. I'm guessing that he wasn't. I never asked about that. I think it was primarily through these old Korean books where the paper was still so wonderful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I worked in the mill, and then I guess I worked there for a month. I would go every day and try to make Korean paper. And I made Korean paper, but I wasn't brilliant. And the last day that I was to be working there, I had brought all sorts of food snacks for the other people in the mill as a thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And the mill was shut down, and he was in the hospital with a heart attack.
Oh.
So I was invited to go to see him in the mill, in the hospital. And I thanked him, and he seemed to be doing okay. And the next day, he had a second heart attack, and he was gone.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was. And so when I got home, hand paper making was just starting, and I asked if they wanted an article about Kim Jong-un, and they said yes. So that's the first writing I ever did about paper.
Okay, so this is Hand Paper Making Magazine, which I think started in about 1986-ish, maybe a little earlier.
It was
83,
maybe a little sooner than that, but whatever. Yeah.
And how did you know about them? How were you connected? Okay. Okay.
I don't know. I must have started subscribing. I have the very first issue. So somehow I knew enough to start subscribing.
Right.
And I saw what they were doing. So I offered an article.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said you went for a year and you spent a month in Korea.
Yeah.
Actually
2 months, because we traveled in Korea for a month.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And so was this, was your husband, did he have a focus too? Or
he just wanted the trek.
Okay.
He wanted not to be at school and he wanted the trek.
Okay.
Yeah. And,
yeah, I want to ask you something because it just popped into my head. You mentioned that trekking got you started writing poetry because of the rhythm of the feet moving.
I want you to
talk about that a little bit.
I just started having lines came to me. I wrote them down.
Yeah.
And I believe it was that rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept writing after that. Yeah.
Okay, and you've taken several trips to Asia and experienced all different kinds of papermaking and seen, I think, traditional versus people that are kind of influenced by other cultures because of what's happened. Not so much that.
There was very traditional. And then there was kind of modernized traditional or not, you know, but I don't think it was particularly cross-cultural at that point.
That makes any sense. Yeah. 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 You wrote a really nice kind of synopsis of the history of papermaking. Do you have that there?
Yeah, I have it here.
I'd love for you to read that.
Okay. The earliest paper was made from hemp rags in 200 BCE. The historic Buddha lived in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE, and his teachings were passed on by word of mouth. 400 years after his death, the same time as the invention of paper, his teachings were codified into the Buddhist canon. Paper originated in China. From there, it spread into Tibet and then over the Himalayas into Nepal and Bhutan. It also moved south into Thailand and Burma and to the northeast across the Korean Peninsula into Japan. Centuries later, the technology was passed to the West by way of Chinese papermakers in Samarkand.
Yeah, I love that synopsis. Thank you.
Yeah. And Buddhism was at the core of it at that point.
Right.
Because Buddhism required written down things.
Mm-hmm.
And so paper, whereas in India, where Hinduism is not about written things. And so the paper from there was very, very different.
Right. So, you wrote this wonderful book, and I'm going to blank on the title of it right now.
What is it? Paper and Threshold.
Paper and Threshold. Yeah. And it's about spirituality and the uses of paper. And what were your first interests in that? Probably through observations on these trips to Asia.
Okay. I actually have been trying to think about this because I couldn't remember. That first trip, I photographed every paper making, everything that we saw. And when we got home, I just looked at all the slides. And I started connecting to what a percentage was that had to do with connection to the world of spirit. And so that's how I identified what I had seen. But I didn't see it until I got home.
Uh-huh. And you kind of connected these different
things. I started connecting
it. Yeah. Yeah, and we had this correspondence for the past few days, and I loved what you said about some people dive really deep into researching one thing, but you did what you just said. Paper was the thread, I guess. And there are other thread in India, you mentioned.
Well, and cloth, for sure, in India. Cloth.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I also noticed how... the way paper appears everywhere in papermaking cultures, in India, it was thread. And so it was just about, I was very lucky that we kept traveling many places because as a result, I saw connections that other people didn't necessarily see. I'm sure, obviously, India is so well studied that people understood that about thread in India. But people weren't talking about the connections in paper at that point that I was aware of.
Right. So give me a couple of examples of things you saw.
Of paper that I saw. Things over doorways. Mm-hmm. Doorways are always portals. When you go into, as you're approaching a Japanese temple, there are rice straw ropes hung with folded white papers, and that is a shiminawa, and it is really what started me thinking about all of this, because it is both an entrance way, and don't come here if you're not. The paradox is that something can be opposite. And I actually was looking into this because I couldn't remember half of this yesterday and noticed that I had various quotes from people about how if you thought that there was just one thing, if you didn't see the oppositions within a kind of archetype, you only saw half of it. You had to see both. And then you had the full picture. And so I started seeing that.
Right. And the subtitle of your book is called, it's Paper and Threshold. So we're talking about thresholds. That's often where the paper appears. And then the subtitle is The Paradox of Spiritual Connection in Asian Cultures. So this is what.
Correct.
Yeah. Ah, wow. Okay. Yeah. What countries did you travel to? And just tell me a little bit about the papermaking discoveries.
Well, Japan, Nagashizuki, Korea. Yes, Nagashizuki, but it's not called that. And the paper screens are different. There's no decal. There's just you dip and you throw the screen back and forth. And the fiber, the slurry is just spewing off both sides. And so it's a very different sound. It's a very active sound in the papermaking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Thailand. Mostly the paper that I saw in Thailand at that point was not good, but the best paper I saw was in the Northeast, and it was in the North, and it was Burmese people who had fled Burma, and they had set up papermaking. And so it was with a mold and deckel, but poured.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, poured. And
sheets.
I should say, among the things that really made a difference to me, apart from learning about what the paper was doing, was, for instance, in Burma, there was this wooden platform with a roof, and the whole family, the grandmothers, the kids, everybody was sitting there. They're picking the, you know, the bits, and they're, it was the life of paper that also was very, very extraordinary. And it was quite different in different places. Okay, so that was Burma. No, well, that was Thailand in Burma.
Nepal? Did you
Nepal,
go?
Nepal, for sure. Nepal, I meant to think this all through ahead because, you know, this isn't what's on my mind lately. But anyway, the first year I didn't see any papermaking because it was October and they were harvesting rice.
Mm-hmm.
But next time we went, it was spring and it was papermaking and they had floating decals. And by chance, I ended up in this village, but somehow somebody told me to go. And then much later, I saw that I had a note of the name of the village, but that was after looking for paper everywhere in Nepal and just seeing nothing good or interesting. And then in this one village with very good paper. So hung out there for a while.
Okay. And your travels were not on any kind of tour. You just
never
sought
no
out.
Tour.
How did you find these paper makers and how did you navigate the languages and
good question. I can't remember. I would
hold
ask,
up a sheet of paper.
I didn't do that, but
no.
I would ask. We fell into them. We didn't always fall into them. And sometimes it was pretty bad. And it seemed to me, okay, in Nepal, yes, we made a point to go to papermaking. So I knew. So that was through Elaine Koretsky had written about paper in Nepal. That was the connection.
Okay. I was wondering if there was any overlap. Okay.
Yeah. So we went there and spent a couple of weeks there. And again, it was just so fantastic. And so my interest in the kind of anthropological connections was probably through the phenomenal experiences of hanging out with these papermakers. And paper really was their life. And that was so real and so alive that it was very compelling.
Right. So, describe, I think you spent a couple days with several.
Spent a week or more. Yeah.
Okay. So describe one situation, like morning till night, how the papermaking worked, if you can remember. So you already mentioned that, you know, it's very, it's a time of year that they make paper.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, let's do the Shan papermaking because that is so clear in my mind.
Okay.
Just what happened. So, the paper, they had a shallow vat on legs.
Where was this again?
In northern Thailand, but it's the Burmese, the Shan papermakers.
Okay.
And so there were these kind of vats, but shallow vats, and they had the molds were bamboo, and they would float the, and then they would pour beaten fiber onto. So mold and deckel is what it was, but no, anyway.
Poured technique.
And then raise it up slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, it was hard for me to see into this shallow layer of water and fiber. but I began to learn how you kind of looked a bit obliquely, and then you could see what the formation is and fiddle uh-huh. with the formation a little bit and slowly lift it up. Okay, uh-huh. And once they had it on the cloth, well, bamboo and cloth, they would take it outside. They were already outside, but they would lean it up against something, and then they would fill mold after mold after mold and so put them all out to dry.
They had like 100 or something, a lot of
at least 50
molds,
probably
at least 50.
Yeah.
And
it's warm there. So by the afternoon, the paper was dry and they would pull it off and refill them.
Mm-hmm.
Next morning, they would do the same thing. And some of the women would be sitting there pounding bark. Everybody was just hanging out. The kids weren't necessarily working, but they were hanging out and they were kind of picking it up. And the first article I wrote about paper making was about, no, that's wrong. Anyway, that's wrong. Anyway.
Well, you've written a couple.
Yeah, the first article was about Kim Yong-yong, but then shortly after I wrote about this. And what it turned out was I keep mixing up Nepal and Sean.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you have to understand that my brain has gotten rather muddled of late.
No problem. I'll put a link to those articles. And if listeners, if you don't subscribe to Hand Paper Making, I'm not sure that you'll be able to read them, but maybe.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to make sure that you know about my how-to books about papermaking and paper crafts. My latest book is called The Art of Papercraft, and it offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. I also have two popular books about papermaking. Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, and The Papermaker's Companion. All three books are available on Kindle. Now back to our conversation.
What were the Sean people making this paper for?
I was just going to tell you. They were making it. There was an old couple, and the old man would form a sheet of paper, and we have another sheet that was already made and dried, and drop it into the mold. And so he was making two-ply paper for books. Mm. And they were full of, then he was making geomantic drawings and all this stuff, because he was, I wouldn't say a shaman, but he was very connected spiritually. So, but the rest of the paper was one, just regular one sheet. And a lot of it was to wrap opium. So it was good, strong paper. There was a lot of opium around there. And one of the days, a woman was sitting there and she had you could see where a bullet had just gone next to her head, because she had been in the forest at the wrong time. And she was fine. But it was, kind of fraught there in the Golden Triangle.
Right. So there was a market for the paper
there was a market,
Yeah.
I never saw it for sale anywhere. So I think people just arrived. People who knew arrived and bought the paper and took it away. But I never saw that transaction.
Wow. How many trips did you make to Asia? Three or four?
Three trips, which were 10, 9, 8 months. Yeah.
Okay.
But then I was back and forth a number of times.
And did you plan to write a book, or did things just happen organically? Okay. So you were just following.
I had no plans.
You were following your spirit.
I was.
Okay.
I was.
Okay.
But, first, First, I had talked to Peter Thomas, and I had sent him this small writing about this, and we decided that we would collaborate on a small edition of books about paper, and I had drawn pictures from my photographs, and he had plates made, and so there were an edition of who knows how many, and then there were a small edition of more elaborate ones. So yeah.
Oh,
so
did
then
that have a name, that book?
Yeah, that had a name. Where is that? You'd be able to find it here.
And was it about, it wasn't Paper in the Himalayas. No. What is it?
No, it's called Meditations at the Edge, Paper and Spirit.
Ah, oh, okay. Okay.
Okay, so I was on to the same thing. And so I made that. And then out of that, I kept going back and taking more photographs and doing more things. And so then it worked out that Hand Paper Making would publish the big
portfolio.
Yeah, folio.
And so you had was, a sample
in that
in
case,
that.
And it has writings about many of the different mills and the different processes, because some people were doing Japanese style and some people were doing Nepalese style. And And I had a lot of thoughts at that time, because I watched how the UNICEF project was really interested. They weren't interested in paper. They were interested in taking care of the kids. And they thought if the paper makers would make more money, then there would be more possibility that the kids could go to school. And
Okay, so tell me about this UNICEF project, and how did you come across it?
I don't remember how I came across anything, but I must have known about it. And
where was this? This was in...
So the UNICEF project was in the fairly high altitude in Nepal, on the way to go to Annapurna, but not that far.
Okay.
And I guess I had seen some of the, because probably anybody interested in paper may have seen some of the products of the UNICEF project, which were very, very beautifully designed, in the sense that they had artists who did illustrations of people making paper or something very traditional to Nepal. And the paper was very good quality. The UNICEF had come up with three different size cups. And so they were making three different weights of paper, and they would measure them by putting them in the cup. So it wasn't just whatever. Uh-huh. And it was good paper. It is good paper. And at the same time, the Japanese JICA, J-I-C-A, Japanese International, I'm not sure what it stands for. They were had a set up to train people in Japanese papermaking.
In the same area?
Well, no, that was in Kathmandu.
Okay.
That was in Kathmandu. Okay, same so, country. And I could see as we trekked, because I would see papermakers all over the place, and the Japanese trained papermakers required a whole lot more expensive setup.
Mm-hmm.
And then when things broke down, the paper got worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the paper makers quit making Japanese paper. Some, I think, probably just plain quit, and some went back to Nepalese style. But UNICEF was really interested that women could make some money, that they were, it was really a social experiment. And the paper making was just a way that they could try to take care of villagers.
Right.
In Japan, I'm not sure what their purpose was, but it was to reproduce Japanese papermaking, which is problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so much more skill, you know, specific kind of skills. So much, it's very demanding.
Yeah, it's interesting how paper. Yeah, I went on a project in South America one time, and it was funded by a big organization. I think CARE. I'm not positive though. And yeah, you hear about this like grassroots versus top down, and they brought all of this equipment in. They did use some things that were there, but the people making the paper were in a tiny village where the power was not reliable. So they couldn't have a beater there. That had to be somewhere else. So they were trucking in pulp, and I don't know. It just seemed a little wonky. I mean,
it seemed a little wonky.
The intentions are right, but the way to get there, I mean, we have so many issues in our world that we can't figure out, right? So this is just another one. Yeah. Tell me, I love this image of you trekking and seeing papermakers everywhere. Like, was this like every couple of days or every day multiple papermakers?
It just depended because some places there were no papermakers.
Right.
And I was still very involved with weaving. And so in India, but Japan, I mean, Japan has such brilliant textiles. Well, Korea, I mean, they had very good textiles. So I was doing a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And how, well, we first flew, the first place we really went was, I don't know. Anyway, somehow we would have an idea that from Korea, we'd go to Japan, and from Japan, we figured out how we were going to get there. We almost never flew. Once we got to Asia, we had to fly into Burma in those days. But mostly we took buses. I think that was part of the core of it, although it wasn't conscious, that we were traveling with people as they traveled. And we had what we could carry on our back. And every 3 months or so, if we had bought stuff or whatever, we packaged it up and sent it home. Mm-hmm. And we'd go on to the next place.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned that your daughter went with you at least on one, maybe all of these
three
trips. And that was, that made you sort of assimilate better. Not assimilate,
I
but
think
you
so.
Were
well,
welcomed in because they
were the first, at least, well, the first trip for sure, we did not see a Western child ever.
Mm-hmm.
I began to wonder if they wondered if we knew how to make babies. Turned out we did. It was when we were in Japan, and the first trip, she was always on my husband's shoulders, and people would run off and buy something and hand candy up to her on his shoulders. They loved it, and she was little and very blonde.
Uh-huh.
And it was a real entrance to us and a kind of trust that. Before we left, my parents said, before we left Canada, my parents said, you have to send her here because we'll never see her again. They were so nervous. As it turned out, we made a very big effort to make sure that she would be fine. So that changed, you know, how we traveled. We didn't take stupid chances.
Right.
We did crazy things, but we didn't take stupid chances. Yeah. So there was a kind of, as a family, we met families, and that was was great.
Mm-hmm.
So as much, I mean, the papermaking was the core, but the fact that we traveled as a family was kind of an underlying layer that opened things all over the place for us.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that must have made a real impression on your daughter as well. Being a young
child.
Well,
the first trip, she kind of hated it. She, every time we were in an inn, she would set up a school situation. And the second trip, she was still a little. The third trip, we waited an extra 2 years so that she would be finished before she went to university, finished high school. And by that time, she really chose to come with us. But yeah. She was often still going. But anyway, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, then she ended up majoring in anthropology and women's studies. And, you know, she came to understand that it had been pretty amazing what she had been exposed to.
Right.
And the kindness of people everywhere.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your book and how did that come about? It's published by the Legacy Press.
It is. I guess I kept thinking that maybe I would make a bigger book because I had all these photographs. Mm-hmm. Then Kathy Baker asked if I wanted to do it. I think that's how I said, of course. Uh-huh. Did I ask her? She asked me. I can't remember. But anyway, so we decided to do it. And I wrote it all up because I hadn't. Well, I had written up some of it for articles, but probably even in the course of writing it, I probably came to understand stuff I hadn't understood before.
Sure.
That's my guess.
Yeah. You have to revisit it and think about it and think about how you're going to put it together in the book format.
Right.
I could see how that would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is available through, and I'll put a link in the show notes, through the Legacy Press, and I think
maybe
Oak Knoll Books
because eventually Kathy had printed way too many and they pulped a whole lot of them. I think one of the ways it's available is to Google it on
Amazon
or one of those. And
that's why it came up through Oak Knoll then, because they are a reseller.
Okay, right.
So, yeah. All right. So it might be a little expensive. I'm not sure.
It's more expensive than it was originally.
Right.
Although at one point, Kathy knocked the price way down, and she still couldn't get rid of them. You know? All I can say is I've written 6 books, and I haven't made a cent on any of them.
So, yeah, what your other books are poetry, is that right?
3 books of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
This one, Paper and Threshold. 1 book of garden letters between me and a woman who lived down the road. We wrote letters back and forth and about the garden and kind of where the thoughts went. And what's the other book I wrote? I wrote another one. Oh, yes. In the street of the Temple Cloth Printers, about Ahmedabad, India. We had an introduction to Haku Shah, who was an absolutely brilliant artist and anthropologist. And so when we, in Ahmedabad, and he suggested we go and meet Vagi, who was this temple cloth printer. The temple cloths are connected to the mother goddess, the worship of the mother goddess. And there are these events that happen where they sacrifice a bullock and everybody, I think they drink the blood, but I haven't seen it, whatever. Anyway, so we met Vagi and he was one of the most inspiring people I ever met. He lived on the street. He and his wife slept inside a room, which was probably about 6x6, and their kids slept on charpoys on the outside and in the street. I mean, these people had nothing. But he had a smile because he was, in effect, channeling the mother goddess. And that was what he did. And I was so knocked out. And the block prints illustrate all sorts of the old stories and myths. And he made a book. He stamped many of the blocks in a little book for my daughter. And she was 8 that year. Mm-hmm. And I was so mean, I wouldn't let her color in them. And then I thought, well, we better go back and make a book about Vagi. So we went and hung out there for a couple of weeks and photographed. And so that was my other book.
Yeah, I had pulled out this other quote from the very end of your book, Paper and yep. Threshold, that I'd love for you to read.
I can do that.
Okay. And then any thoughts you have about it after you read it?
I offer this text as my hymn to paper, paper made from living tissue, and to the hands and the harvest, hands that harvest the paper, cook it, beat it, form it into sheets, to the artists, writers, and printers who work with it, and to the worshipers who trust their thought and vision to paper's warm reception. Touch the paper, touch the soul of the paper maker, touch the earth's gifts. Do not think too hard. Breathe the paper. Touch mystery.
Yeah, I love how you weave in everything, like life and the plant and the experience. I think one of the thresholds you mentioned was burning paper.
Yeah.
And can you talk about an experience with that?
Offhand, that's interesting. I have to read the book and find out what I knew.
Okay. I don't know why that popped into my head.
Yeah.
That's okay.
What became really clear to me through reading, and particularly through reading about Japan, and I just remember the Catalpa Bow is a book about a very early Japanese religious way of dealing with the worth. And it goes really back to shamanism and to the very core of being. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, because it's such a good fiber, mulberry was traveled all through the world. And somehow as it moved, this understanding of life in through the plants, and it's mm-hmm. the cambium layer. And we know that if you peel a stick completely, that's the end of that. But I just was on Vancouver, an island off Vancouver Island, where there's a very, very wonderful grove of trees, and you can still see the historic place where they would cut enough and pull back the bark, and we use it for weaving. So this is an indigenous, and I wish I thought that the world would connect to this stuff. I mean, we are, no one with a brain in their head can deny that we're in climate crisis.
Right.
And this whole thing is so much about connection to earth, to life, mm-hmm. and to the cycles of life.
Mm-hmm.
And we go, but more come.
Right.
And this really, I think what I would say, in India, I felt like I came to understand more about what life is, because there are so many people you would just see who were living so much at the edge, and yet the generosity was so often there. I'm not talking about the guys on the in the tourist town who are just after you and tormenting you, but in the villages, the spirit of the humans, of the way of living, and their work, which was so connected to a metaphor for life, it changed me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what are you doing these days? I know you're not working with paper. Are you writing a lot? Or
I'm
gardening?
Still writing. Yeah, I'm of late. I am. Last couple of months, these tiny little poems keep appearing, just what I see.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gardening. It's not the best gardening year, but I'm trying to get some food out of the garden. I've been doing a lot of collage, and mucking up paper is what I'm doing. That's kind of what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have a lot of paper
that you've
amassed. I have it. And I just found another stash yesterday. So it's great. As soon as I find more stashes, I can muck them up more and not think they're too precious.
Wonderful. Right. Okay. And you had a couple of recommendations. Tell me about Eskimo Realities. It's a book by Edmund Carpenter.
This is a book by Edmund Carpenter, who I don't know if he's still alive, probably not, an anthropologist, about a lot of this stuff, about the concepts of living. And Inuit would say, all this art, it's nothing. It's just kind of like, what do fingers make? But you just can throw it out. Another thing about just connecting to what makes life alive and worthwhile. And it's a brilliant book. What else did I recommend?
So he studied the Inuit, is that right?
I don't know anything about him, but this book,
it's called Eskimo Realities. I did read another one.
He wrote also a book called Oh, What a Blow That Phantom Gave Me. So there's some of the same old playing around with paradox.
Right. I'm
very interested in the art, but the Inuit wouldn't have said it was art. It's just this, just like this shit that your fingers make.
Okay.
Which is awfully enlightening when you think about what they're selling paintings for these days.
Right.
The billions.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you also mentioned the work of Imran Qureshi.
He's just an artist I came across at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. I just think his work is just absolutely fantastic. And it makes connections in a way. Anything that makes connections that surprised me, I think, is good medicine. Because it's very easy to get all like this. And it's good if someone tosses you out somehow.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, art can do that. Wonderful.
Yeah.
The work of Muna Kata.
Oh, great, great Japanese block printer. Black and white. Just so strong and so simple and so strong. Just, he is so there. So, I mean, I could have listed this many things, but those popped into my head.
Yeah, yeah.
I looked on my bookshelf.
Yeah. I'll link to those in the show notes. And then you gave me a couple of links where we can find out about some of your books online. So I'll post those as well. And thanks so much for coming on the show, Dorothy.
Oh, thank you. It's a lot of fun to talk and reminds me of everything I've forgotten.
Great. Well, be well.
You too.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon. There's a reason besides the season to make a change.